Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to a two-part Pesach, Rav Dessler, and Psychology series. Tonight's year almost didn't happen because I was looking around to find Rav Dessler on Pesach. I showed you in the past different holiday volumes of Michtav Me'eliyahu. There was one for Elul, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Chanukah, Purim, and there wasn't one on Pesach. And I saw online there was a Rav Dessler Haggadah, which is no longer in print. It was printed in 2016 or 2017. Apparently it didn't have the demand that this year does, and therefore they stopped printing it. And every farm store I went to, I wasn't able to find it. So I did some scrounging around online, and I got a secondhand edition of the Haggadah of Rav Dessler. It's a nice shot of him over here, which I ordered on Sunday. And the only question was, is it going to come in time for the next week's shir? And it came today, just a couple hours ago. So I prepared this shir using some of the online databases that have a copy of this, but now we actually have the sefer in person. And it's very exciting that we have an opportunity to learn to prepare for Pesach using the Haggadah of Rav Dessler. This is not actually written by Rav Dessler on the Haggadah. The authors took different pieces from Michtav Me'eliyahu and all of his other writings and put it together on different passages of the Haggadah so that it's a nice resource to use on Pesach. You know, growing up, my father, who's here tonight, hello, my father always had a line. He would say, on Zoom, it's not like hiding in the, not like hiding in the corner behind the bookshelf. He had this line that he would use all year long whenever we asked too many questions, which as kids we tended to do. My father always said, save your questions for Pesach. If we asked about the rules weren't fair and, you know, bigger allowance, so why can't we go there, why can't we do that, save your questions for Pesach. Well, you know what, one year we took an entire year's worth of questions and we wrote them down as questions to save for Pesach. And we were at the Seder and we got to the Manashtana. My father said, okay, who's going to start asking the questions? So my sister pulls out this gigantic list. My father said, what is that? She says, you told us to save all our questions for Pesach. Well, it's Pesach, and I have a lot of questions. Why couldn't I go to that mall that time 6 months ago? And why isn't my allowance bigger? And when can we get a different backyard? And can we move to West Hempstead already? Well, all these very important questions that, you know, we saved up for a year. My father said, no, I meant Pesach Sheni, so I'm not going to take those questions tonight either. But Pesach really is the holiday of questions, especially the holiday of questions from kids. And we don't give the same answers to the kids in what questions they're asking because the kids aren't really asking the same questions. Haggadah gives us different types of kids, different types of questions, and therefore, they all get different types of answers. Except for the Russia. He gets oral surgery. He asks a question and he gets a knuckle sandwich, which is really hard to understand. Dessler has a beautiful approach to describe different types of questions. I'm really going to hone in tonight on the question of the Russia and how it's different than the questions of the other Banim, and really to get a better understanding of Emunah, what Pesach really is all about. So I'm going to share my screen. People live have copies of the sources. We do. So this is Rav Dessler Haggadah, starting on page 87. On the very bottom, no, on the middle of the page. So Rav Dessler says on the passage, can I get Arba Banim? We're going to talk about the four sons. Rav Dessler says, Yesh Gimel Bechinos, B'she'elas Kushios. So three different types of tough questions. Three different types of people who are asking, not just curiosity questions, but there's three different categories within those who are asking questions. Akasha. Akasha means something that's bothering us, something that doesn't make sense to us. There's three different people, three different types of ways of asking questions when something is bothering us. Aleph, number one. Yesh maksha kushya b'toras pircha she'en alav tshuva. People ask a question in a way that there's no answer to this question. I'm not looking for an answer. I just want to state my opinion in question form. Vanquish yaso ella apikorsis. This person is asking to reject, to promote their own opinion of doubt, and just express themselves, but they phrase it in question form. Sho'ef hu laharosha Torah mufrechas, chas v'shalom. The real intention of the question, quote unquote, the question is just to show that this person is unhappy with Judaism, with Mesorah, things don't make any sense, it's stupid, chas v'shalom. And the person asks the question just to express their dissent. V'zoi gedar she'las harasha. The Rasha really is expressing his frustration and his difficulty with belief in question form. What is this that you're doing? Beis, a second category of those who are asking a question. V'yesh maksha ma'ayin u'motza teretz liyashiv. Person asking a question with the intention of finding an answer. Zo b'chinas Torah. That's how learning goes. Shesho eif lahavin u'levayer. By asking a question, you raise a difficulty which forces you to search for an answer, and the question is raised for the purpose of looking for an answer, and there's something deep emerges from when there's a depth of study and understanding. The question is necessary to bring out a lot of understanding. And then, Gimel, V'yesha sher b'hargisham, b'kushya chazaka, sho'alim li'atzmam lama lo avin. when they feel something isn't right, something doesn't make sense, only they don't phrase it as, it doesn't make sense, they ask themselves, why don't I understand? Yodim heim sha Torah amitis, the Torah and its values are true. So they don't phrase the question as, why is the Torah saying that? It makes no sense. Alatmehim al ezechiyasam lahavin. They ask themselves, why doesn't it make sense to me? What am I missing over here that prevents me from having a true connection with this source, with this value, with this mitzvah? In brackets, he says, Zau asher kushiyaso hi begeder kushiyal atzma. The person really is asking on him or herself rather than asking on the Torah. Who's famous for his questions, printed out on the side of the page of the Gemara, a question on the Gemara, a question on Rashi, a question on Tosfos. Rabbi Akiva Eger doesn't phrase the questions as, Tosfos makes no sense. Rabbi Akiva Eger writes, Lo zachisi lahavim b'Hashem yara enai. He says that it doesn't make sense to me, I'm missing something, Hashem should give me the knowledge to figure it out. He could have phrased it as, that makes no sense, but he had the humility to recognize when the words of a gadol in Kal V'Chomer, when the Torah itself has a mitzvah or has a value that doesn't seem to fit with our understanding, the kasha is not asked as, this is stupid or this makes no sense. The question is phrased as, I'm missing something. I must not be understanding. These are the three categories. The Rashi doesn't really have any questions. He's just stating his disapproval or frustration in question form. Is that the Chacham who really wants to understand, who really wants to delve deep and understand and figure out an answer to have great depth and Torah knowledge? And three, I don't know if it fits up exactly with the Tam. It could be a Tam who doesn't have the full knowledge, who doesn't understand. All of us could be each of these people in different areas of our life. He concludes this section with a quote from the Altar of Kelm. We mentioned in the past he was related both biologically and certainly methodologically from the Altar of Kelm, student of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. Al kusha shemakshim bebechina zo amar, the Altar of Kelm, sha kusha atzma hihi hateretz. Sometimes the question itself is the answer. Da kusha mevarera shalo iyanti kedabai v'lo hevanti karoi. In category three, the one who's really asking on him or herself, why don't I understand? In a sense, that question really is an answer. It's saying, it makes sense. The answer is, but I'm not fully understanding. I must have missed something in the background of the sigya. I must have been working with a faulty assumption. The problem is with me. That itself is a type of an answer. Now, the reality is that this idea that sometimes the question is the answer, that instead of asking questions, we mistakenly ask answers, is actually the best way to understand the problem with the Rasha and why it's so unusual how we respond to the Rasha so harshly. We knock on his teeth. We don't even answer him. What exactly about the Rasha's question implies that he has an answer already? Let's turn to the next page. This is page 2 in the booklet, and it's page Peitas. We're skipping a little bit in the Haggadah. Gotta move things along to get to Shulchan Aruch. We gotta really move through the Haggadah. So on the bottom, he's talking about the Rasha's question now in particular. Before, I was just talking about questions in general. What's important to think about, when does someone's question represent a lack of respect or just looking to express their anger? And when does this person really have a question? And look what he says, a beautiful idea to understand the problem with the Rasha's question. On the bottom of the page, Rasha Mahu Omer. Ba'atzam ikir kushiyasav shel harasha nov'os mibidosav hara'os. The truth is, he says, the Rasha's questions stem from something much more than an intellectual curiosity. The Rasha's questions really, really come because of something fundamentally wrong with that person's midos. They're arrogant, or they're selfish, or they're obnoxious. There's something wrong internally. Ki terem sheyishlo ta'adam b'midosav. When a person has yet to conquer their midos, a person is not refined and humble, v'yishabden al hashkafa ha'tahora la'emes, i'afshar shetiyena hashkafos of amitios. If their midos aren't right, then their opinions and their philosophies can't be right either. Huro'eh mashi yirtzeh, this person has desires for money, has desires for lustful desires. Person has this desire to eat and travel to wherever he or she wants. Umachria besichlo maskanos asher yachbots. And the intellect discovers sources and ideas that lead the person to the conclusions that they've already arrived at from a lustful or desirous or greedy perspective. Ki mishuchadhu b'midosav. V'nogel ratzonosav. Person is biased by their own opinions. A person is called a bribery, right? If a judge is taking bribes, then the judge is already skewed toward the truth. And the judge might say, Rashi and Chumash quotes this, a judge is not allowed to say, I'll take bribes, but to judge fairly. I'll just take money just for the case, but I promise to judge according to what's fair. I'll take money to speed up the case, but I won't possibly rule in favor of one person over the other. The problem is, the pasuk says, Hashochad ya'aver enei chachamim, hu chok muchlat. The Torah doesn't have two ways about it. The Torah is very decisive and very definitive. It's unequivocal. When a person takes a bribe, their mind is skewed. And even if they think they're thinking logically, They think they're working through a very intellectual, philosophical, theological lens. Their mind is going to be skewed toward the result that favors whatever bias is bringing in the money, or whatever seems to indicate some kind of personal benefit. On the bottom, he says, "Mishum ze anu motzim lefamim chachamim misaskim b'she'elos chamuros b'philosophia." Umakshim mafalpalim, they're people who seem to be very intelligent, and they ask the most difficult questions about Bible and biblical criticism and about this and the age of the universe, and they have scientific questions, and they seem to be so intellectual. They seem to be operating through very cold and very academic perspective. Achamistakel bebayos hahein mitzad kochos hanefesh shel. On the next page, page 3. Hadam, if you look at who is the person asking these questions, and what are they trying to conclude before they even ask the question? A person has already solved all their perplexities. The questions are already solved in their mind. They would love to have a conclusion that there is no Hashem, that there are no mitzvos, that there are no restrictions for what can be eaten, or who they can sleep around with, or where they can go, or what they can say, or what they can buy, or which people they can interact with. It's much easier that way. And if they already have a bias from a financial, or a desirous, or a selfish, or a greedy perspective, then their intellectual questions are also going to be skewed toward that which they already want. On the next line, where it's underlined, V'yeshi achshov shebali dei maskana ba'omek sichlo. The person believes they arrived at the conclusion using only theological, philosophical, academic, beautiful intellectual reasoning. V'eina ala genevas daito. The person's just tricking him or herself to believe that they're being totally cold and totally neutral. There's something personal, there's something very much tempting about living a life without mitzvahs, living a life without a Ribono Shel Olam. And if that's really what they could arrive at with by asking questions, well then maybe their questions are the way to arrive at what they already want to do. How does that come across? What do you think about that? I see you hemming and hawing.
It's just a rationalization.
It's a rationalization. It's an easy way out, and if I can get there and prove it to myself, I'll feel better about myself, and then do the things I already want to do.
I heard a shiur once. I can't remember who the rub was who they were talking about. But there was a student who approached him and said, "Why do you want to answer my question?"
I have the story. I'll get to it soon. Very good.
All right.
But we're thinking the same way. I won't let you steal my story. But yes. I'm going to get to that story very soon.
I have questions.
Right. Very good. Yeah, we'll get to that. Very good. Very, very good. We're thinking along the same lines. Right? So he goes into a little bit of depth over here. We've already said, but really breaks it down for us in the next paragraph. He says, Nispone na'al adam rasha, apikoros, habala chor mechadash, person who says, I'm going to come to with a fresh look, fresh perspective, v'smicha sicho b'vad, purely using intellectual reasoning. Abayos akronios, with fundamental problems I have, kigonam nivra ha'olam b'tachlis mechuvenes, was there intelligent design? How old is the universe? Evolution? People of all kinds of quote-unquote, good, strong questions. It always confuses me, because for the last thousands of years, whatever the other form of belief was, it was always the greatest question. From pagans, from Christians. Again, the fight with Jewish people intellectually in all these debates in years past, talking thousands of years ago, wasn't about living a secular life or a free life. It was, why are you not subscribing to the gods of Canaan? Or before that, for Egypt. And going later than that, about the nations of Israel, the Canaanites, all the different nations. And going down to the Greeks and the Romans, all these debates. And every single time it was, you're so closed-minded. You Jewish rabbis, Jewish people, you're so closed-minded. And then all those pagan ideas, those idolatrous ideas were also debunked. And then they didn't believe in it either. But every time something came along, it was always, look at the narrow-minded religious people. You go down to the Haskalah, and you go down to the later reform and nowadays, it's a different type of question that comes up, that people are insensitive and everyone is racist. The question is always there, but even the science changes all the time. What science believed 10 years ago is not what science believves now. Certainly 50 years ago, or 100 years ago, or 500 years ago, or 1,000 years ago, every single time it's against science. Okay, that science is actually garbage. The age of the universe, and about the outer space, and about plants and animals, dinosaurs, it's constantly evolving. No pun intended. It's constantly evolving. But each time, it's against religion. Oh, by the way, the science has been debunked, but this new science, which is also against religion. So why does it have any more weight than our Masorah? because they, current scientists of this generation say so, the scientists tomorrow are going to laugh at the scientists of today. The only thing that's consistent is our Mesorah. So the next paragraph is Naniach. We can work with an assumption, Sha'adam Zeh, who's this Russia we're talking about. Russia doesn't have to mean that he's evil in the sense of like a giant handlebar mustache and a monocle and a big hat. Nothing wrong with those things, but just how villains are always portrayed in media, cartoons. But it doesn't mean the person has to be openly nefarious. If anything, these people often come across as unbiased and wearing a lab coat, and they seem kind, and they're fighting for social justice. They seem to be a caring, kind person. The Russia doesn't always look like an evil person with the top hat. The Russia just means the person whose questions are not really questions. They're not really curious. They're just meant to poke holes and express their opinions. So we can assume, he says, that they're probably Sha'adam Zehu Baal Seicha Charif. They're very intelligent. Milumad, they're knowledgeable, maskil, they're sharp, and they're wise, and they're cunning. Although Mashino Gale Midos, when it comes to their character, they've never worked on that. Hineu Ishame Olo Nichnas, but Ove Hakora Lavora Alatzmo Beritzinut, Kirela Hafechas Tiv O Hagas, Ulasake Midos of Haraos, people who have never spent time in self introspection. Asking themselves, how do I conquer my base desires? How do I find a way to perfect myself? How do I find a way to be more giving and more caring? It's nice to preach being a kind, giving person. Definitely told the story here before, but I'm going to tell the story again. That they say about Bertrand Russell, who was an English philosopher and mathematician, that he was always preaching about ethics and talking about ways to be a good person. But apparently, rumor has it, in his personal life, he was a deplorable human being. He was cheating on his spouse with someone else, and cheating on that person with someone else, and he was stealing money from the university he was working at, doing all kinds of terrible things. And one time after a lecture about morals and ethics, one of his students came over and said, you know, you're always preaching about morals and ethics, but you yourself live against all those values. And he says, I see no contradiction. You know, I taught math for many years. No one ever asked me, why aren't you a quadrilateral? There's no connection between what I'm teaching and who I am. Even when it came to ethics. He believed he could teach about ethics, but behave however he wanted. It didn't matter to him. So a person who has the great intellectual knowledge but has never worked on him or herself to try to conquer desire or delay gratification or to truly have empathy for someone else, in Yaliveo Misha, when they're offended, Yikom v'yitor k'dabai, they take revenge, they're angry, bear grudges. Im yasa ma'asa meshubach, if they do something right, Yidrosh min ha'kol es ha'kavod ha'raylo, they're always seeking out self-aggrandizement, always looking for attention, always looking for praise. In Yavalide Nisaya, when they're faced with a challenge against their values, Lo Nuchalev Toach Bo Shalo Yilich, Shalal Biad Yitzro, Gam Betavos Pechusos Acheros. The person is faced with a challenge. We have no reason to believe, to trust, that there'll be anything but falling into the traps of even the most silly and the most disgusting types of behaviors. And this is the person raising the philosophical questions. The questions themselves may have give us pause to think about, but when they're asked by a person who clearly has their own biases, their own conclusions in mind, well then we don't care how good the question is from this person in this setting. On the surface, he appears like a good, kind, fair, rational person, like a researcher who's cold and just wants to figure out the truth. But the internal characteristics the person has never worked on, it's going to lead a person to another direction. In the next paragraph, when a person like this, who we describe as being have no self-control and never working on overcoming grudges and not seeking out a lot of attention for their accomplishments, when that's the person asking fundamental questions, let's not fool ourselves to think that a person like this is neutral and completely cold intellectually and just trying to figure out without any problem against the alternatives from what he wants to conclude. Person, when they come to a situation, they always have some kind of preconceived notion or some predetermined intended outcome of interest. And when it comes to this, a person wants to figure out which one do they decide more, which one do they think is the right way to come. You know, in psychology, this is called the confirmation bias. People tend to discover things that confirm what they already believe. You have news pundits who hear the same story on the news, and it's become so polarized and so not bipartisan, whatever that word is, I guess partisan. So partisan that each fan base turns into their cable news 24-hour news cycle, and they're listening to the same news through the filter of those who editorialize, and they put a spin on it in a way that, yes, this is a problem with socialism, capitalism. Oh, this is exactly the problem with this president on this side, or the president on that side. This candidate versus that candidate. It's the same fact, but it's interpreted by each in a totally different way. It confirms what they already know. And people continue to widen the gap between the two sides because they're just getting new information, more information that confirms what they already believe. And they're taking it the other way. They have the conclusion before they have the facts. And all facts are twisted to give each person the outcome that they already wanted. Many years ago, when psychological studies first started, and this is true also for drug companies, they used to do tests where they would give medications to people and they see, does it work? Oh, they feel a lot better. They're no longer depressed, or they no longer have gout, or they no longer have headaches. But they realized something called the placebo effect. And sometimes people feel better because they're doing something. A doctor is telling them they're going to feel better. So they started to have blind studies, which means that they would tell the participants, you're getting medication. They would only give half them medication. The other half would get a sugar pill, a placebo. And in that way, we can actually see if everyone believes that they're getting medication and they don't have any, and they have the same desired outcome, how do we separate the placebo effect from the actual effect of the medication? You know what happened then? The results were still skewed. Because the researchers still, they were hoping to prove that their drug worked, to justify years of research and zillions of dollars. So the ones who took the drug, they said, oh, you can see the headache went away. They didn't really mean it that way. And they started interpreting the results differently for those who took the medication, those who didn't. So they had to come up with what now is called double-blind studies. Double-blind studies mean not only do the participants not know if they're getting the actual intervention or a placebo or the regular non-drug or non-treatment or non-whatever, but the researchers also can't know which people are in the control group and which are in the experimental group because they also are going to be skewed toward the results they already want. Everyone in the study, over the years, they've figured out, who knows how many people, God forbid, died during studies that weren't done this way. Oh, this drug is safe. It really helps people. Eventually, over time, it became more understandable that when people come in with this sense of what's going to be right, or I believe this drug's really going to help, and they're not evil people. They got no mustaches for any of them, right? Especially the women, right? It's not the kind of thing where they're coming in looking to destroy the world. They believe with true honesty that this drug is going to change the world. And the participants believe they're getting better. No one's lying here. It's an unconscious bias that people are going to have their inquiry lead to the result that they want. They're going to absorb new information. They're going to discover new findings in a way that conforms and confirms what they already believe. It was a study in 2011 with psychiatrists where they tested confirmation bias. It was a fictitious patient where the diagnosis was already known, the ones designing the study. And they gave the psychiatrist very little information, and they asked him to give an initial diagnosis. How would you treat, and then what drugs would you prescribe? And they started to then give more and more information about the patient's history, about their symptoms, about changes over time. And a good 15%, which doesn't sound like a huge number, but again, 15 out of 100 psychiatrists stuck to their initial diagnosis, completely ignoring or butchering the new symptoms that came up because it didn't necessarily contradict their first diagnosis. Despite clear and hard evidence contrary to their first diagnosis, challenging the regimen of medicine that they were prescribing, potentially lethal compared to what they were first thought it was, they stuck with it. And they found a way to rationalize and explain how the new findings don't necessarily go against it. 15% of doctors, 15 out of every 100, were prescribing drugs that can really kill someone because they first prescribed it this way, they first thought about it this way, and even contrary opinion. These are psychiatrists, supposed to understand the mind. But even them, they weren't immune to the confirmation bias. Now, Rav Dessler on the next page, on the bottom of this page, bottom of page Tzadi, page 3, he says, Zoi kvar bebaya bodedes shenogas ulai rak lefaret lepradachar mechayav. That this would be true about a person who has a question about one thing in their life. They're studying this drug, or they're studying this treatment, or they're studying this cream, or they're studying this book, or they wanted to study about, you know, just evolution or just one thing. So you want to say that a person has one area in their life where they have a financial or other bias which pushes them in a direction that they've already believed is right. When it comes to Amunah Hashem, this is not a small-ranging question where it has a limited effect on what the aspects being questioned are. This is all encompassing. Achukal tochen chayav taliba. The issue being raised over here is there a God? Is there a need for scharva? Is there scharva onesh? Is there a really objective morality out there? When that's on the chopping block, this is not just one area of the person's life where they have a slight bias that they're paskening on this case or testing this drug. This is the entire existence of the person, which has wide-ranging effects to every aspect of their life. The kalulos bepisrona nafkusos rabos totsos ma'od. And the consequences of this decision, is there a God or not, has so many far-reaching consequences. Hanogos l'kol acha mirotzonosav u'l'kol achas mimidosav ishiifosav l'kol yamei chayav. It's going to affect every aspect of life from morning till night for the next 80 years, 90 years. If there is a God, then I need to be respectful. I need to live my life differently. That's a hard thing for a person to do. And now we'll get to the story. The story goes that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, that's who the person was, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik had a student in Volozhin who was very learned, very knowledgeable, and Rachmana Litzlan got swept up in some of the movements, the Maskilim and Reform, and he went off the derech. He wasn't behaving like a firm yid anymore, and people heard he had a lot of strong questions, and he left the yeshiva, and many years later he came back to sit down with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, and he sat down and he said, you know, I have so many strong questions I've gathered over the years. Would it be okay if I asked you my questions? And Rav Chaim said, I'm happy to listen to any question you have. But first, I have one question for you. When did you think of these questions? Were they before or after you started being Mechal Shabbos? Or you started eating out in random places? And I said, it was after. I was already not keeping Shabbos, and then not keeping kosher, and I had these questions. So Rav Chaim said to him, well, then I don't want to listen. Questions, I can answer. But you don't have any questions. You have answers. And I can't answer your answers. That's how it goes. I can't answer your answers. You came to the conclusion before you asked the questions. You rationalized your way of thinking to permit a life toward Chilul Shabbos. And who are we to judge necessarily and say what the challenges are financially or the strong taiva? It's for our Kaddish Baruch Hu to judge. But for us to hear questions from, quote, Russia means a person who has not worked on him or herself. For a person who's blinded by a taiva to not keep Shabbos, or a taiva to work in an unethical way, or for a person to eat or be with whoever they want, that would be eat food and be with whoever they want, if that's exactly what's going to pull a person in those directions, then their philosophical questions about Bible criticism and authorship of the Torah and age of the universe, and those are good questions to grapple with, but if they're coming after the person has already decided, from life is not for me, or I can't possibly live in this way, well then, they don't have any questions. They have answers. And how are we supposed to respond to answers? And if you think about it, we don't really respond to the answers. As we said before, when the Russia asks this question, we don't really respond to the Russia's question. Everyone wants to know what makes the Russia's question so much worse than the Chacham's question. The Haggadah says, he says, the Russia wants to know, he excluded himself from the whole group, therefore we knock on his teeth and don't talk to him. But the Chacham also says, we don't say eschem below low, and because he excluded himself, he's out of here. This question is eschem versus lechem. Eschem could be inclusive, lechem could be not. Very detailed, but there's a much more fundamental difference. My friend spells this out very nicely. You look at the words of the Chacham. The Chacham's question is introduced, ki yishalcha bincha, when your son asks you. The Tam's question is, he's asking. By the Rosh's question, it doesn't say he's asking. He doesn't really have questions. He has statements. He has declarations. He has opinions. He has editorialized comments. He has an opinion already. The Chacham, the Tam, and one doesn't know how to ask. He doesn't know how to ask. But the Chacham and the Tam, they're yishalcha. They're asking questions. So regardless of whatever else word makes in there, aschem, not aschem, the point is they're asking because they want to know. So we have answers. You on your level, you on your level, but you have questions to ask. And if you don't know how to ask, we'll teach you how to ask because asking is important. When the Russia gets up there and he says, He'll say, he'll speak, he'll state his question in question form. What is this stuff? I'm supposed to answer him? Well, you see, we were in Mitzrayim for many... He's not interested. He has answers. He's stating them. In question form, maybe, but they're rhetorical at best, cynical at worst. He doesn't have any questions. He has a lot of answers for himself. Secondly, Rabbi Fran quoted the Shemin HaTov. If you look at it, there's another word that appears both by the Chacham and the Tam that doesn't appear by the Rasha. Ki yish alcha bincha machar lemor. That's the Chacham's question. And for the Tam, v'haya ki yish alcha bincha machar lemor mazos. They both have the word machar. How is machar so different? The Shemin HaTov explains so beautifully. The person who's really asking, they're not depending their service on the asking. They want to know, but they ask tomorrow. On Pesach, they're doing it. They're going to have the carbon Pesach, they're going to have the matzah, the mar, sipri tis mitzrayim, they're going to make kiddush, they're going to observe yantiv, they're already observing it. Machar, after they already observe it, they want to know, so what was that thing? Why did we do that? I'm curious. I'm doing it regardless. Nasa v'nishma. I'm going to do it. But I want to know more. I want to understand more. That's how we were makabal mitzvahs. Nasa v'nishma. We ask a lot of questions, right? Someone wants to ask a Jewish person, why do Jews always answer questions with questions? And he said, why not? The Jewish thing to do to ask questions. We encourage questions. We love questions. But it can't be that the answer is going to be holding up the observance. The Rasha doesn't ask machar. The others ask machar. But the Rasha says, he says instead of asking, and he's stating it today. I will not do this until you explain to me why I should. In a defiant way that's not open to hearing an answer. Because he has his answers. He knows what he wants to do and what he doesn't want to do. We say, Hakei Ashinov. How do you interpret that? It means take out the bluntness of his mouth, the sharpness of his mouth. Either way, we're not engaging him in conversation. We're almost taking out his teeth to say, we're not going to let you talk anymore. There's no reason for you to use your teeth for talking because you don't really want to talk. You just want to do. When that's really the perspective, when a person wants to know everything before they can do anything, then nothing we can tell them will make any difference. Following idea, said in the name of the Kutzker Rebbe, Rabbi Sol Salanter, and many others, that is strange. On Shabbos, we say, Ein Kelokeinu, Ein Kadoneinu, Ein Kemalkeinu, Ein, there's no one like Hashem. And then we ask, by the way, Mi Kelokeinu, Mi Kadoneinu, you just said, there's no one like Hashem. And then you ask, so who's like Hashem? Shouldn't we first have said, who was like Hashem? No one's like Hashem. Who's like our king? No one's like our king. Why don't we first say, no one's like Hashem, and then we say, by the way, who's like Hashem? So the Kutzker Rebbe and many others explain that we can ask questions about Amuna, we can ask philosophy, we can ask the greatest questions about Torah and science and evolution and age of the universe. There's a lot of good questions to ask. But they have to start with a fundamental anchor of belief, Enke Elokeinu, Enke Adoneinu, Enke Malkeinu, Enke Moshiinu. We have that firm belief and it's not questioned. Now that it's not questioned, now we can question it. I have questions because I don't already have other answers to find out. If I'm firm in my belief, another example is, we say this in Kedusha, the Malachim say, Kadosh, 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 Hashem Tzvakos, Melocha La'aretz Kavodo. God's glory fills the world. And then they ask, I am a Kom Kavodo. Hey, where's Hashem? Where's His glory? You just said, Melocha La'aretz Kavodo. What do you mean, Shalom Zelazeh, I am a Kom Kavodo? Malachim, and also for us, wants to confirm and affirm that Melocha La'aretz Kavodo, then you could ask, I have questions, I want to wade deep. Chazal have an expression that Ein lecha ben Torin al misha osik b'Torah. Chazal darshan charas al aluchos, cheras al aluchos. That only a person who has true Torah values is free, which kind of sounds backwards. You'd think a person who is living a Torah lifestyle is so confined, restricted, limited. But a person who's free, they're hefker. They can go wherever they want, say whatever they want, eat whatever they want. It would seemingly be, that person seems to be as free as possible. I like to think of it in terms of a person with a life jacket, right? A person going in the water, and they're going out to a very vicious sea. And they're out there in the ocean. The person who's anchored to the boat is able to start exploring a little bit. Because they know if the tides come and push them away, at least they're rooted back to a sense of safety. A person who doesn't have any link back to something that's anchored or stable, they're scared to explore. Or they're the ones who are going to get swept away because they have nothing holding them back. It's those who have... Charas alaluchos, they're engraved on the heart. They're engraved in Torah values. Those who have a strong sense of Ein kelokeinu, Meloch halaretz kevodo, when they have a strong sense of tethering back to a source of amuna and a source of knowledge, that's the kind of person who's going to be able to withstand the seas of life and be free to explore. They could explore. They're not going to get swept away because they already decided Enkel Okenu. But those who let their taivos, let their curiosities for other types of pleasures go out there, they're not going to be able to really roam free at all. So bringing it back to Rav Dessler, where he concludes this discussion, we're on page 4 right now, in the middle of the page. Middle of the page in the second paragraph, starting with Lachain. He says, Lachain gam gedolei haseichal nechshalo. Even those who are so brilliant often stumble and they get swept away. Nechshalim gam hayom bekfira. All generations, they get lost in the sea of questions. And Rachman al-Atzlam, they don't remain true to the faith. Mishum kach, ein eitzel lemi she'asak b'sifrei minus, el bebitel hanegios. It doesn't help for a person to engage in philosophical books and reading biblical criticism. A person who's not strong and steady with those questions is going to get swept away because they're so blinded by the result that they already have in mind. L'sh'of l'haktines ha'shelo l'shma b'masav l'srachek mi'pinius l'inyane olam hazeh ad kama she'efshar. Until they have the ability to start having some self-control about anchoring themselves to a more independent perspective that's not blinded by their own desires. We'll end with this. Maya says, "Zeh she'yeshbo mi'midos ha'taivos." So what are you supposed to do? How are you supposed to practice? A person who really does have strong desires, how are they supposed to conquer them? Apparently you're telling me it's not with questions. A person who has strong desires to do things isn't going to solve those desires by learning more philosophy, by learning strong proofs of the Torah's existence. That's not going to do it for a person who's struggling with behaviors. They can't break a certain behavior of stealing or engaging in inappropriate behaviors. They're not going to solve that by researching the Torah. That research will only lead them to end up allowing what they already are doing. How are you supposed to overcome that? He says, that person won't be helped by intellectual and academic searching. This person has to start working on doing it nasa v'nishma. B'li hischachmus, without a sense of great, amazing understanding, b'chinuch v'hergol l'masei mitzvos, doing by rote at the beginning, even if they appear im gam chitzonim b'roshisam. In the beginning, they may seem superficial. U'b'limud ha-Torah b'hasmada, by studying properly, u'la'at la'at yuchlu shut ha'vosav v'yizdachech libo. Over time, he'll start to feel it. You fake it till you make it. V'azizke la'muna p'nimis acha. And eventually, he will start to believe it. We have it backwards. We've said this so many times before, and it's always important to review it. Sefer HaChinuch says, Achrei HaPe'ulos Nimshachem HaLevavos. People always believe that, okay, I'll do it when I feel like it. I'll change my behaviors when I truly believe Hashem runs the world. I'll stop being Machal Shabbos. I'll stop going here. I'll stop eating this. I'll stop engaging in that terrible behavior. When I can work on my Amunah, then I'll act better. It doesn't work that way. Achrei HaPe'ulos Nimshachem HaLevavos works both ways. We call it the cognitive dissonance. A person doesn't usually change their actions to match their intellectual beliefs. A person usually changes their intellectual beliefs to rationalize and match the things they're already doing. And so while it's really hard to change our beliefs, we can change our actions. The Sefer HaChinuch develops this idea first in the context of Yetzias Mitzrayim, because this Pesach, this time of year, is the most important time to work on this very Midah. The Sefer HaChinuch points out there are so many mitzvahs related to Yetzias Mitzrayim because it is the core and most fundamental of our belief system. And a person who struggles with believing in Hashem is not going to go through this season and come out a bigger believer in Hashem or believer in Torah and Hashemayim or Hashlecha Pratis. They're not going to come out of that by studying the academics or the intellectuals or analyzing, did it really happen? Where's the archaeological evidence for Yetzias Mitzrayim? That's not going to bring them closer. Oh, I really believe it now. So now I'm going to start putting on tefillin. Now I'm going to start davening. Now I'm going to start giving more tzedakah. Now I'll be kinder to my family. It doesn't work like that. A person needs to start by the doing. And that's the Sefer HaChinuch's point. The mitzvos are so many. There's the tefillin and the tzitzis and pidyon haben and there's the matzah and there's the maror and karban pesach and esrei chametz. There's so many mitzvos at this time of year and really all year long that we do in order to act out the beliefs of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Because it's the behaviors. It works in both directions. If the answers can influence the questions, so then if a person doesn't believe, they're never going to believe. But if we commit to actions of belief, then the beliefs will follow. For a bit of time, it may seem like a hypocrite because it doesn't seem to be matching what I believe right now. But Achrei HaPe'ulos Nimshachem HaLevavos. A person lives out the mitzvos of this Seder. They don't just tell the story. They live the story, which is our topic for next week in Rav Dessler. But a person who's able to truly internalize and truly able to actualize and experience the Seder, experience Yetzias Mitzrayim and all the mitzvahs that go with it, that is the kind of person who is able to truly live a life of emunah. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu introduces himself to Bnei Yisrael Har Sinai, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, Asher Hotzei Sicha Me'eretz Mitzrayim, that is kind of by the Rambam and the Sefer HaChinuch as the source, the mitzvah to believe in Hashem. And it's linked to Yetzias Mitzrayim. This is the time of year. Pesach is the Chag, where it's the main avoda, is to work on Amunah. But we see from the Seder, not all kids get it the same way. Not all people of any age get it the same way. Our takeaways for tonight are that there's different ways to ask questions. There's a right way to ask a question, and there's wrong ways to ask questions. The wrong way to ask a question is to already have a preconceived notion, to fall into the confirmation bias, to come in totally looking for the answer that, whether a person realizes it or not, is going to justify or rationalize what it is they already want to do. When a person lives like that, they're not really asking questions. They're stating, like the Rasha states it today, because he needs to know. But the Chacham and the Tam, on their own level, every person on their own level, needs to ask, and ask tomorrow, after affirming Enkei Elokeinu. And this is the season to truly find a mitzvah, one or two, or more than one or two, because there's so many at this time of year, to truly affirm our belief, to have a chance to engage in these mitzvahs in a way that transforms our emunah from questions to answers. So next week, hopefully, we'll continue this discussion, moving it toward actualizing it. How do we use the Seder as an opportunity to not just talk about the story, but to actually live it experientially?